MoPC.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Well, our next guest says the 2020 presidential election will determine the very survival of American democracy. He writes, to restore popular faith in government and win the election, Democrats need to nominate and elect an economic progressive. His book explains how the failure of the economy to serve ordinary Americans opened the door to President Trump and how democracy can be taken back from President Trump. Our guest is Robert Kuttner. He is a distinguished professor at Brandeis University. He's co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's a former columnist for Business Week, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. He's written a new book called The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. And Robert Kuttner is our guest next on WMNF. Bob Kuttner, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Why'd you write the book?
I wrote the book for two reasons. First of all, I think everybody except the hardcore Trump electorate would agree that American democracy is very much at risk if Trump is not either impeached or voted out of office. And the book goes through all the ways that democracy has been weakened and all the ways that democracy would be weakened even further if Trump were elected for a second term. The other reason I wrote the book is to make the case that it isn't just the democracy that's been weakened, it's the fairness of the economy that has been weakened. That's what opened the door to Trumpism. And so it's important not just that a Democrat win, but that a Democrat who is committed to taking back the economy on behalf of regular working families needs to win as well. Those are the two key takeaways of the book.
Let me go back to your first point. You say several times in your book that Trump is a would-be dictator, that we're close to fascism. Give us some examples why you think we're headed in that direction if President Trump gets a second term.
Well, one, of course, is his view of executive power. He assumes that he has the power to govern by decree. And the courts, because the courts have been increasingly inclined to that point of view, have cut him a lot of slack. Secondly, I think the ground was softened for that by all of these laws that give a president in a real national emergency the right to use executive power in a really extraordinary way. And of course, a lot of the ways that Trump tries to use executive power are not true national emergencies, but he behaves as if they were. He's also overridden the independence of agencies that have a tradition of not just bending to the will of a president like the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. He's tried it with the IRS. And sadly, the usual barriers against this kind of dictatorial behavior have been weakened over the past half century, not just by Republicans, but by Democrats in the context of the Cold War, in the context of 9/11. So the ground was softened for a would-be dictator in several respects. So on all counts, it's really urgent that we have to take back our democracy. The other point is that separation of powers only works when the three branches of government are really separate. And in the first 2 years of Trump, you saw a Republican Congress giving him just about everything he wanted, making no room for the Democrats to play the role of a legitimate opposition. And you saw the courts pretty much giving him what he wanted. So the whole notion of the founders of this republic, that separation of powers was the best defense against tyranny, that's also been weakened.
When Fox News viewers, though, watch TV at night, and when the president uses his executive power to try to limit immigration across the southern border, Fox News viewers are seeing what seems to be giant groups of people trying to come across the border, and that engenders fear, I think, into those people. And they say, yes, there is a crisis, and the president is doing the right thing. What would you say?
I think there are some real crises out there. I mean, China eating our lunch economically is another crisis. And the fact that Fox News is, for all intents and purposes, an extension of the White House message machine also makes it easier for Trump to do what he does. But yes, let's focus on immigration for a second. It's a genuine problem. And the fact that liberals, on the one hand, want to be humane to bona fide refugees, but on the other hand, don't have a very good answer for the question of what we do with this flow of refugees, lends Trump some credence. On the other hand, Trump violated the normal prerogatives of a president when he just decided to reprogram money to build a wall that both parties had explicitly refused to appropriate money for. But any legitimate crisis gives a president an opportunity to behave in a tyrannical way, and other presidents have tried to solve the immigration crisis without behaving like a dictator.
Well, our guest is Robert Kuttner, and his book is The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. You say in your book that in 2016, in that election, neither of the two major political parties were addressing the nation's real problems. What were the real problems you think that the voters would have embraced a candidate over had that candidate said the right things?
I think the most fundamental problem is that for something like 30 or 40 years, the living standards of most Americans have been either flat or declining. And the American dream of being able to be part of the middle class, bring home a decent paycheck with a secure job, buy an affordable house in a decent school district, have your kids aspire to go to college without a lifetime of debt, have decent health coverage with your job, have a decent pension, that's getting away from more and more and more Americans. And I think Democrats, as well as Republicans, were so enamored of this holy grail of globalization and so committed to the idea that all we need to do is deregulate finance and deregulate the economy and everything will just be rosy, that both parties had lost credibility with a lot of working families. And then when you have a candidate on the Democratic side, such as Hillary Clinton, who is taking huge speaking fees from Wall Street, $400,000 or $500,000 per speech, must have been a heck of a speech, she lost a lot of credibility with the traditional Democratic base, plus the fact that she ran a kind of campaign that put identity out front, seemed to care more about immigrants than she cared about locals. And all of that gave Donald Trump credibility that he might not have otherwise had. I mean, statistically, a majority of white women voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. That's just astonishing, given all the crude things he said about women, given the fact that Hillary Clinton hoped she would be the first woman president. So it's an indicator of how that wing of the Democratic Party, the kind of pro-Wall Street, pro-corporate wing of the party, had lost so much credibility with the ordinary base of the Democratic Party, namely working families.
President Trump, when he was a candidate, talked about bringing manufacturing jobs back, targeted China. You said China was eating our lunch. The president used China as one of his main attack points during that 2016 campaign. He promised to bring manufacturing jobs back. He campaigned hard in some of those former industrial heartland, yes, in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan, picked up enough votes in some of those states to squeak by a win. Was the president sincere, do you think, in trying to revive the prospects for working class America?
I think he was basically right about China, but because of his impulsiveness and his short attention span and his bombast, I don't think he's delivered. That is, if you were serious about getting China to change its behavior, and you were serious about bringing back manufacturing, you would appreciate that this requires careful, patient diplomacy. One of his absolute best hires was his chief trade negotiator, Robert Lighthizer, who started out as Reagan's chief trade negotiator. And the Reagan administration, because of the concern for military matters, was actually pretty good. The problem in that era was Japan. in making sure that Japan did not make off with all of America's vital technologies. So Trump started out with a reasonable set of goals, but if you look at how he's gone about accomplishing them, I think he's blown it sky high. The Chinese have decided that this guy is not a serious negotiating partner. He vacillates between flattery and insults, and we are further away from a deal with China than we were a year ago. China is diversifying who it exports to. It's decided it maybe doesn't even need the United States. And so there was a window. Had Trump allowed Lighthizer to negotiate a deal, well, we might have had a deal, but that's gotten away from him. And furthermore, he never was really serious about bringing back manufacturing jobs to the United States. Tariffs alone don't do that. You need some kind of industrial policy of the sort that many other nations have. But because the rest of the Republican coalition doesn't like industrial policies, Trump didn't do that, and so all that was left was the bombast, and that really didn't deliver for the people who supported Trump in the hope that he would bring back manufacturing jobs.
You mentioned Lighthizer. Isn't he negotiating the replacement for the NAFTA agreement? It's almost complete, right? So has he negotiated a good agreement? Is it appreciably different than the old NAFTA?
It's not appreciably different. In a few areas, it's a little bit better. For example, in the area of auto parts, they increased the percentage of the automobile that has to be made in one of the three North American countries in order to qualify for tariff-free entry into the United States. They require an average wage in the auto industry in the three participating countries, Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., that's around $16 an hour in order to qualify for tariff-free treatment. On the other hand, it gives even more away to the pharmaceutical industry in terms of longer patent protection, harder to get generics. So it's a combination of some improvements on the one hand and some sweetheart deals on the other hand. And it's a very close question whether that's going to be ratified by Congress. I mean, for the past 2 months, Lighthizer has been negotiating with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats to see what kinds of improvements would be necessary in order for Democrats to vote for it. Even if it's passed, Trump maybe can claim victory, but it's not going to make much of a difference.
Yeah, and I saw Richard Trumka on Fox News on Sunday, and he said he's not going to back it. Trumka, of course, being the president of the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, so their condition for backing it is that several improvements have to be made on it. You know, you mentioned Fox News, really interesting straw in the wind. Who knows how long this is going to go on, but Trump has gotten into a spat by tweets with his most reliable supporter, Fox News, where he's annoyed at some of the polls. Fox actually plays it straight when it comes to polls, showing that his approval rating is down. And he said they don't work for me anymore, which caused several people at Fox to sort of profess to be bona fide journalists and to say, we don't work for you, Mr. President. We cover you, and that's not the same thing. So he is so impulsive. He has such a thin skin. He is so petulant that I think he is at risk of even alienating his own base, as well as blowing deals that might have been possible, like a grand bargain with China.
Our guest is Robert Kuttner. He's the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's a former columnist for Business Week, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. He holds the Ida and Mayor Kirstein Chair at Brandeis University. He lives in Boston. The book is The Stakes. All right, so, Bob, you say that if the Democrats want to win, they shouldn't nominate a moderate. They should nominate an economic progressive and look for some radical changes in policy. As I watch MSNBC and CNN, they're always downplaying people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, the progressives, and they're saying that Joe Biden is the one who can win for the Democrats in November of 2020.
Well, two responses to that, Rob. First of all, the great submerged issue in American politics has been the declining living standards and the declining life prospects of ordinary working families. And Biden talks about a return to normal. Normal is not good enough. Normal is what has savaged working families for the past 30 or 40 years. And I think if you really want a massive turnout of people who are aggrieved of the sort that voted for Trump, Democrats have to be serious about doing something for that part of America, which, of course, is a majority of America. Secondly, I think one of the things that could sink the Democrats is all the divisions on the subject of race and identity. And the way you bridge over those potential splits is you talk about things that unite black and Hispanic and white families and immigrant families, and that's, am I going to have a decent job? Are my kids going to go to a good school? Am I going to have reliable health insurance? And so the more you talk about those unifying issues, the harder you make it for Trump to divide the Democrats on the basis of race or gender or who's local and who's immigrants. And I think, thirdly, Biden is an unfortunate standard bearer for the people who think that a moderate needs to be the nominee. He's past his prime. He was prone to gaffes even during his prime. And the people who take a very close look at the polls will tell you that the support for Biden looks like it's higher than anybody else, but it's very soft if you press on it. And Biden doesn't do that well on the stump. He stumbles. He doesn't do that well in debate. He stumbles. It's only early September. We've got 14 months to go until the election. And we'll find out whether he can survive the process of the primaries, the precinct caucuses, because if he does, I think there's good reason to worry that he's one Democrat who Trump could just trounce.
I think it was in that first debate that where one of the reporters asked the question about the medical care and referred to Medicare for All as a government takeover of the entire medical system, which is not true. That's not what Medicare is all about. But it would seem that if you're Bernie Sanders, if you're Elizabeth Warren, you have a hard time explaining to people that haven't studied it what single-payer Medicare for All is. How do you make the case for single-payer? If you're going to be an economic progressive, that's one of the things you're going to have to fight for. How do you make the case?
I think you make that case by being very careful about the transition. The best idea I've heard is an idea that has been floated in a bill by Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut. And here's DeLauro's idea. You say to employers, you have to either provide health insurance for your employees or you have to pay enough money so that the government can provide it. And here's the cute wrinkle. We will make it very attractive for you to meet that obligation by paying into the Medicare trust funds on behalf of your employee, and so employer coverage becomes Medicare. And you do that over a period of time so that people can get used to it, and also the Medicare coverage that replaces the employer-provided private commercial coverage is even better. Because although people are attached to their employer-provided coverage, if you really push on that, they don't like the co-pays, they don't like the deductibles, they don't like the lock-in where they're afraid to change jobs for fear of losing or having to change to worse health insurance. They don't like the fact that employer-provided policies are more and more heavily managed. So even though it looks like you have a free choice of doctor and hospital, in practice you don't. And of course, under Medicare, you have an absolutely free choice of going to whatever doctor and whatever hospital you want. So I think as people get more accustomed to some of the details, and granted, some of the details are daunting, and as the Democrats get better at talking about the transition, I don't think that's a divisive issue. I think it's actually a winner. I don't support the Sanders version of this because I think it's too abrupt.
You're looking for a new Roosevelt. You talk about FDR and Teddy Roosevelt. They were both good, if I could use the word, salespeople. President Trump was a good salesperson. What was it about What was it about Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt that made them be able to get their progressive agendas in their time through the Congress?
Rob, it's a great insight. They were both optimistic, and you could say they were both good salesmen. And in both cases, they took advantage of popular frustrations that had not been addressed by the political system. In Franklin Roosevelt's era, it was obviously a more severe, more acute Great Depression. But in Teddy Roosevelt's era, it was all the dislocations of the first wave of industry. And if you have a leader who's a good narrator, a good storyteller, a good salesman, who's an upbeat personality, who can articulate the lived frustrations of regular people, that leader can win a landslide. And both Roosevelts were exceptionally popular. I mean, had Teddy decided not to run for a third term, he easily was primed to win a third term in 1908. And, of course, Franklin Roosevelt, won a third and a fourth term. So I think even though what we have is more like a hidden depression than an overt depression, nominally the economy is doing great. It's under 4% unemployment. But for so many people, those jobs are unreliable jobs. They're jobs that don't pay well. Housing's unaffordable. Healthcare is unreliable. And so people experience this as a sort of hidden depression. Trump was able to tap into that much more effectively than Hillary Clinton. And if the next Democratic nominee doesn't tap into it, articulate it, champion it, then there's a real risk that Trump wins again.
We're talking about the book, The Stakes, with its author, Robert Kuttner. You say that President Trump was a racial nationalist, and what you're looking for, you think nationalism has gotten a bad rap, that people should not be afraid to use the word nationalism. You have suggested using terms like civic nationalism and economic nationalism. What do you mean by your brand of nationalism?
Well, and I use the term economic patriotism. I mean, if you look at big multinational corporations, they're not patriots at all. They'll move operations offshore. They'll go to wherever they can get the cheapest workforce. Their supply chains will move out of the Midwest and into countries that pay, you know, their workers a pittance. So I think, number one, we need to have our corporations be economic patriots. Secondly, I think it matters whether manufacturing continues in the United States. It matters whether the United States has state-of-the-art technologies and emerging industries or whether we just cede that to China. And government policy, you know, if you look at the Pentagon or if you look at the National Institutes of Health, these are unacknowledged industrial policies. We have leadership in a whole range of aircraft because of the spillover of the Pentagon. We have leadership in biotech because of all the money that NIH spends. And so why not acknowledge that there is a practical, proactive role for government and use it to help restore, reclaim manufacturing and produce good jobs? We pioneered solar, and because China gets away with predatory practices, China has pretty well taken all of the world's solar production. And we could take that stuff back. It was invented here. Some of the jobs that it provides are good jobs. It could produce a whole industry that could make profits, but with some loyalty to the United States of America. So I think the sort of centrists who think that there's something shameful about economic patriotism and think that globalism is the key, they're just opening the door to Trump.
So you have a list of suggestions at the back of your book about how to take some of these progressive ideas and make them popular, and also, if the Democrats win, it's a really a program. It's a roadmap for the future if the Democrats win in 2020. You talk about infrastructure. I was shocked. You point out in your book that 100 years ago, a train traveling from Chicago to New York would travel faster than the current train does today. Is that true?
Absolutely. I looked it up. An hour faster. And with the exception of one route, which is the New York, Boston, Washington, Acela train, which is about where Europe was 50 years ago, we don't even have 20th century rail infrastructure. We have 19th century rail infrastructure. And, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers, which is a completely nonpartisan organization, says that the shortfall in basic investment in infrastructure, roads and bridges and public buildings and not even fancy high-tech stuff, is $3.7 trillion. So that creates a lot of jobs. That creates a lot of jobs for blue-collar workers. That creates a lot of opportunities to modernize technology. And that's win-win-win. We haven't heard Trump talk about that. I mean, we've heard Trump talk about public-private partnerships where most of the money supposedly comes from the private sector, although Trump hasn't explained why the private sector would put up that money. And if you have been to Europe, you realize just what a disgrace American infrastructure is. I was in Japan for Business Week almost 40 years ago, and you know, Japan already had its bullet train, which is faster than anything the United States has today 40 years later. So there's low-hanging fruit. There's a huge opportunity that business ought to support, that both parties ought to support, that creates millions and millions of good jobs.
This is a dumb question, but if China has great airports and is building a pretty phenomenal network of high-speed rail, if Japan already has high-speed rail, if the rail system in Europe is light years ahead of ours, how does it make society better and more productive?
Well, in the first place, it means that fewer Americans have to use their cars, so it's good for the environment. Secondly, it's convenient. We ran an article in the American Prospect about transportation policy as housing policy. I live in Boston, where there's a horrible housing shortage in the Boston. Anywhere, you know, 20 or 25 miles out is completely unaffordable. But you go 50 miles out to a town like Worcester, which has very good housing stock and affordable prices. You can imagine a lot of people who work in Greater Boston living in Worcester, living in some of the outlying older cities, but try to get to work. The commuter rail from Worcester is antiquated. It takes an hour and a half. It's on one of the Amtrak lines. It's completely unaffordable. So there are convenience reasons. There are environmental reasons. And also, it would take some of the pressure off the horribly congested cities where, because public transportation is so unreliable, people are being thrown back on their cars, and we're just choking on that.
Well, we're talking about the book, The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy, with the author, Robert Kuttner, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. There's an interesting startup that you mentioned in your book that I think is based in Silicon Valley, and it's all about whether to take computer coding jobs and send them to Bangalore, India, or to send them to places like Kentucky. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, this is the brainchild of Silicon Valley's really interesting congressman, a guy named Ro Khanna, working in partnership with some Republican congressmen. And his argument is, gee, if we're sending those coding jobs to, as you say, to Bangalore, why not send them to West Virginia and Kentucky, where American kids can make 40 or 50 bucks an hour instead of working at the local Walmart? And they've just done this as a pilot project, because one of the questions that comes up is, you take all of the new wealth that's being generated by the new economy, it's concentrated in a handful of metro areas, New York, Boston, Seattle, San Francisco, Silicon Valley. How do you spread that around? And Warren has talked about this. I think of regional development policy to spread some of the new wealth around would go a long way towards redressing the regional inequalities, persuading people who defected to Trump last time that the Democrats actually can do something for them. And it would just be a good thing to do. You know, we talked about the Roosevelts. The New Deal had a lot of regional development policies in it. It had TVA. It had the Great Western Dams. It had rural electrification generally. It had some of the farm programs. And so because so much of the country is not sharing in the new tech wealth, I think a lot of what the next president has to do is focus on regional development, regional equity, at more than the level of rhetoric. Trump, you know, gives a few speeches. He goes into a few places where a manufacturing facility decides not to move to Mexico and keeps a few jobs at home. But it's tokenism. It's at a very, very low level. I think the next president really has to do this for real.
You talk also about the need for a new Bill of Rights for youth. What would that bill do? And why do we need it?
I think we need it because if you look at life from the perspective of a 26-year-old who's just gone off of her parents' health insurance, the job market is unreliable. The health care options are unreliable. A lot of the gig economy doesn't guarantee you a real job, doesn't pay you health insurance, doesn't have retirement benefits. You're looking at astronomical housing costs if you want to buy a house. And you're looking at astronomical debt costs if you want to get a college education. I think if you string all of these together and recognize that this young generation of Americans is getting as much of an economic beating as the Americans who came of age in the Great Depression, you package all of that as a Bill of Rights for young Americans and you deliver on it, I think a whole generation of Americans will be in your camp for their entire political life.
You were famous, well, you're famous already, but you were famous 2 years ago because Steve Bannon from the White House called up and wanted to have a meeting with you. You were on vacation, so you couldn't meet with him. But Bannon thought that there was a conservative Republican like Bannon and a progressive like yourself, he thought that there was some common ground over the issue of China. Do you think that Bannon has the best interests of American workers at heart, or is he interested in something else?
Well, it was very interesting. I had written a column saying that Trump was partly right about China, and Bannon called me to say, hey, Bob, we're soulmates. I love your work, blah, blah, blah. He neglected to put the conversation off the record, and so when he said some very insulting things about his boss that I quoted him on, he got fired. But on the issue of China, where people like me depart from people like Bannon, is that Bannon blends together economic nationalism with racial nationalism, white nationalism. And he was very much the architect of the whole strategy of getting the far right to see Trump as their champion, not just on economic grounds, but on racial grounds. And, of course, there I and most decent people part company with Bannon and, by extension, with Trump. But I think on the economic nationalism part, yeah, there is some overlap, except Trump has completely bungled the execution of it because he is so intemperate, so incoherent, so incapable of being patient. So Bannon is a very, very clever guy, but I think his brand of nationalism is tinged with racism, and of course I can't support that.
Bob, one last question. I mean, if progressives do make the case that their way is better and that it's a practical way to make the country better, I go back to that first debate where one of the panelists asked the candidates, if you have a health care system, would that also mean that you'd provide free health care for undocumented immigrants? And I think most of the candidates, maybe all of them, raised their hands that night when that question was asked. I think for President Trump, he's going to use that as a cudgel. He's going to use that to bludgeon Democrats for saying, well, you're going to let all these people into the country willy-nilly, and you're going to give them free health care. And he's going to use that to divide people that live here against people who want to come here. What should the progressives do about that issue?
I think the immigration issue is an incredibly slippery issue for any Democrat, because on the one hand, most Democrats want to be humanitarian, particularly when it comes to refugees. I think you have to draw a distinction between bona fide refugees and people who are here illegally. I'm a little bit more hard line than some of my Democratic friends on that, precisely because I think Democrats are very vulnerable on that issue. I think if you look at the polls, most Americans want to be humane to refugees, but most Americans are not in favor of open borders. And if Trump can hang around the necks of Democrats, the idea that Democrats are for open borders, that's a hugely winning issue for him. On the question of health care, that's a really close call and a tough call. If if somebody is here illegally and their kid gets sick and their kid has a contagious disease, do you want to be in the position of saying, hey, good luck to you, we're not going to treat you? I mean, if you go to Europe, where there is universal health care, and you show up at a hospital and you're sick, they treat you. And they fight with you later about whether your insurance company pays the bill or you pay the bill out of pocket or they just eat the cost. So I think it's a genuinely, genuinely tough issue for Democrats and one that Trump can exploit. And I don't pretend to have an easy answer because it's not an easy question.
Last question. How do you pay for it? I know you know this. Stephanie Kelton is out there saying that deficit spending is a good thing. It doesn't matter. You can spend as much as you want because the government can print money. And she says it won't cause inflation. So how do you pay for this? And what do you think about Stephanie Kelton's ideas?
I think Stephanie Kelton takes a basically sound idea to an extreme. The sound version of that idea is that when the economy is soft and there's unused capacity in the economy, you can have deficit spending without having inflation. But that doesn't mean you can have an infinite amount of deficit spending. I do think that taxes on wealthy people have been cut under Trump to such a ridiculously low level that you can raise taxes on very, very wealthy people. You can pay some of it with taxation. You can pay some of it with public spending through an infrastructure bank, something like that, that really pays for itself. And, you know, if you look at World War II, we spent an astronomical amount of money, some of it through debt, some of it through taxation of wealthy people. And we got the economy out of the Depression. The economy grew at the rate of about 8% a year through the entire war. It paid for itself. So I don't think the cost of any of this stuff is an obstacle. But I think Stephanie Kelton overstates it, that you simply cannot print an infinite amount of money.
Well, Bob Kuttner, thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to point out about your book, The Stakes, that I should have asked you?
No, Rob, this was really a very terrific, well-informed interview. So I appreciate the care with which you read the book and the questions you asked.
Well, Bob, I hope you'll come back.
I will come back.
There is a lot of meat in that book, and I only touched the surface of it. And thank you for writing the book.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right.
Bye-bye.
That's Bob Kuttner. His book is The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. He is the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's a former columnist for Business Week, The Washington Post, and The Washington Globe. He holds the Ida and Mayer Kirstein Chair at Brandeis University. He lives in Boston, and he argues that the Democrats, if they want to win, should not settle for a moderate like Joe Biden. They ought to push for a progressive, and that he thinks that in the long run, progressive policies will be more appealing to voters and also help the country in a much bigger way than moderate policies. We also talked there towards the end about Stephanie Kelton. She is an economist, and we've heard her here on the air a couple of times in the last year. She teaches at the SUNY State University of New York at Stony Brook, and she has this idea called modern monetary theory. You can look that up. Well, if you want to comment about anything you've heard here for the last half hour or so, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. You can also email the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. There's some news going on, but let's take a phone call first. Just want to say that Hurricane Dorian is still moving slowly. It is inching away from the Bahamas. It's going to the north-northwest at just a few miles an hour. It has been downgraded to a Category 2 storm. We'll have more news in just a moment. Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And let's go to Art in Largo first. Hi, Art. You're on. What would you like to comment about?
Yeah. Hi, Rob. That was an excellent interview. Very enlightening indeed. But my comment is really a question. How can progressive Democrats publicize their Medicare for All proposal when the media is repeating the same mistakes by favoring, in their reports, one Democrat candidate? It was Hillary in 2015-16. Today it's Biden. and both oppose Medicare for All, as well as the leaders of the Democratic Party. So how can the progressives publicize this?
Yeah, and I'm not going to answer for Kuttner. I think you have to read the book. He goes into a long explanation about it. He thinks in the end, once you make the case that there won't be deductibles and there won't be co-pays, and that the actual, your overall cost for medical insurance will drop, he thinks that people will go for single payer Medicare for All.
But my question was, if the media favors particular, how can we beat that?
Well, I think one thing, Art, is to do what you do. You call into radio shows, write letters to the editor at the newspaper, and make sure that your point of view gets out there.
Good point. Okay, thanks, okay. Rob.
Thanks, Art. I don't have a great answer for that. If CNN and MSNBC hosts are largely saying that a progressive can't win, that you've got to, for the Democrats, have to select a moderate, how do you argue against the talking heads on CNN or MSNBC? Let's go to Barry in St. Petersburg. Hi, Barry, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, I love the interview. You did such a great job, and he was very informative. Question that I had was, we just keep talking about immigration and with undocumented or illegal, and he was throwing up the kind of extremes between open borders and being humanitarian. Why have we never discussed that there could be two tracks? The people that are here undocumented or illegally could get work permits to continue to be here, but if they wanted a citizenship track, they would have to go back. Wouldn't that be a good compromise?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a solution, don't you, Barry? I think that Gang of Eight, the U.S. senators that were trying to forge a solution a few years ago, they had some ideas about it. No doubt there's a solution to it.
And that way, you don't either have to leave, but we also get the labor we need, so everybody seems to could be a winner.
Yeah, and right now I know that a lot of construction firms and even President Trump's hotel, his resorts, and some of the big farms, big ag, is importing workers, giving them temporary visas for the labor that they need. There's always problems with that, as we know historically. But, there's got to be a solution, Barry. You know, Barry, I would say that we need good leadership in both the Democratic and Republican Party to talk to each other. Do you have any ability to pull the parties together?
Well, I think that's one of the keys. One of the projects I'm working on is getting Lindsey Cross to take the League of Conservation Voters. It's going to have a bill for their Forever Florida with Senator Joe Gruter. So you're having someone who was a strong candidate for the Florida Senate as a Democrat who didn't win, but taking a liberal organization and working with the chairman of the Republican Party. That's how you start dialogue.
Yeah, that should be interesting. All right, Barry, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Barry is soon to be a host on 820 AM. He's going to be one of the other voices you hear on the radio on another station. Tony writes this: I couldn't agree more that 2020 is likely the last chance for American representative democracy. Defeating Trump and Pence must be paramount, writes Tony. Tony goes on to say that Dems need to motivate enough economically insecure but socially conservative Florida seniors who actually vote in Florida to vote Democrat again. Democrats are making a fatal mistake by not emphasizing the threats to Social Security and Medicare if Trump is reelected, rather than so much on identity and immigrant rights, writes Tony. Tony, thanks a lot. Tony, that topic comes up over and over again in Bob Kuttner's book. So I think you're going to find a lot of common ground with him on that one. 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Kevin writes this: my question is, what would employers do with the money they'd save if they didn't have to pay for their employees' health care costs? Can we expect them to pay more to their workers, or would they just do stock buybacks and the like, writes Kevin. I don't know the answer to that, Kevin. Let's hope that the employers would look at healthcare costs and say, well, since these are costs we currently shoulder, why not give it to our workers and make sure that they're happier and more productive? Let's hope that's the answer. although I don't know, Kevin. 813-239-9663. Just want to read a few stories here. I mentioned the hurricane. There are some harrowing reports out of the Bahamas about the toll that Dorian took on the Bahamas. There are at least five people dead in the Bahamas. And the main airport is underwater. The Red Cross says that more than 13,000 houses, or about 45% of the homes in Grand Bahama and Abaco, were believed to have been severely damaged or destroyed. UN officials said more than 60,000 people on the hard-hit islands will need food, and the Red Cross says some 62,000 will need drinking water. So an enormous humanitarian need over there in the Bahamas. If you can help out, please do. I think Sean Canaan is going to have a report on how you can help out on the afternoon news, so keep your dial tuned to 88.5 FM. Just want to read a few stories that we might talk about. A woman who lived near the West Texas gunman in Odessa, Texas, says she and her family were afraid of 36-year-old Seth Ator. The woman says Ator would go out at night and shoot at animals, mostly rabbits. She describes Ator as a violent, aggressive person. Ator was killed by police outside an Odessa movie theater following Saturday's shooting rampage that left seven people dead. The gunman reportedly used an AR-15-style weapon in murdering those people. Vice President Mike Pence's staff is defending his decision to stay at one of President Trump's private properties while on his visit to Ireland. Pence's staff said this morning that the decision to stay at Trump International Golf Links in Duneburg was made at Trump's suggestion. Pence's office says the club is the only facility in Duneburg that can accommodate Pence's government staff. Joe Biden entered the Democratic primary promising to reject donations from lobbyists, yet a review of campaign finance data from the Associated Press finds he's accepted roughly $200,000 from employees of major lobbying firms. His pledge was to forego money from federally registered lobbyists. That's left him free to take donations from state-level lobbyists and those who lobby but do not meet the legal threshold to require them to register. It's hard to quantify how much Joe Biden has raised from the multi-billion dollar lobbying industry, but according to the AP review, it's far more than any of his rivals. Politico is reporting that the Trump administration may look to offer Venezuelan immigrants special status in a move that could win over some Hispanic voters in Florida. Florida leaders have urged President Trump not to deport Venezuelans who are fleeing their nation, and some have even assured him that the move will help him win the key battleground state in the 2020 election. A Catholic school in Tennessee has removed the Harry Potter books from its library after the school's priest decided they could cause a reader to conjure up evil spirits. In an email obtained by the Tennessean newspaper, the religious leader of Nashville's St. Edward Catholic School says he consulted exorcists in the U.S. and in Rome who recommended removing the Harry Potter books. The priest wrote that the curses and spells used in the books are actual curses and spells, which when read by a human being, risk conjuring up evil spirits into the presence of the person who is reading the text. And President Trump visited his private Virginia Golf Club for several hours Saturday as Hurricane Dorian bore down on the southeast. Trump traveled by helicopter from Camp David from the presidential retreat there to Maryland to his golf property in Virginia. The president gave the impression as he left the White House on Friday that he would spend all day Saturday at Camp David. Let's take some more phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Dennis, who's in Largo. Dennis, thanks. What would you like to talk about? Hi, Dennis. Well, you're on MNF. What would you like to talk about?
Richard just asked, what did we think the employers would do with the money that they save from not paying for health insurance? They'll do the same thing that they did with the money that Trump gave away, almost $2 trillion in tax breaks. $1.1 trillion of that was used for stock buybacks. That didn't improve the economy. It didn't improve anything. It improved the shareholders' pocketbooks.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that Kuttner in his book suggests that what we ought to do with stock buybacks is stock buybacks are mainly a way for a CEO of a company to say, look, I'm doing a good job, because he's artificially inflating the price of the stock by going into the market and buying all the shares that he can, usually he. And what Kuttner suggests is that what ought to happen is that there should be a law that says that a CEO of a company cannot exert his right to purchase shares or reap the reward of the shares for 5 years, so that if he puts the country on a long-term financially sound basis, he'll be okay. He or she will be okay. But they can't reap the reward of the stock price while they're holding the CEO position. So there's an interesting avenue that Kuttner suggests in his book.
Well, that's a great idea, except now we're talking about so much government and interference that would go against everything that our country stands for. We're not supposed to be government-run. If we're going to be government-run, then we might as well just drop out and go to China, because then we're government-run.
So well, the government...
Just saying you can't buy back your own stock is not going to work.
The government runs a whole lot of our economy already. We have
Exactly, economy.
We have...
What you're describing is an actual government interference into how a private company can work.
I mean, he points out that you know, already the Pentagon, through its contracts, really kind of controls the aerospace industry. He points that out in the book. So if it was for the good of the country that a CEO wasn't pumping up artificially the price of the stock, wouldn't that be a good regulation to have?
Oh, I'm not saying it's a bad regulation. I'm just pointing out the pitfall of it.
Yeah, well, and we're at the point where
we should just give the Pentagon a whole lot more money so that Trump can raid it and take it and go spend it somewhere wherever he'd like.
All right, Dennis, thanks a lot. Thank you for your phone call.
Thank you.
All right, good to hear from you. And let's go to Alan in Tampa. Alan, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, I've listened to your program, and I don't know your political leanings. Can I ask whether you lean left or right to start off the conversation?
I lean practical. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's left. I've heard Donald Trump be put down on your show. I was power washing, literally, just to put some legs on the caller. I was power washing my deck and had to shut it off to call in to your show because I'm sick and tired of people putting down our country and putting down our president. Donald Trump's the best thing that ever happened to this country, and let me tell you why. Because if Hillary Clinton had gotten in, Katie barred the door, we would have never known the corruption under Obama that's about to come out about them spying on a political campaign for president of the United States. That's unheard of. And I want to say something about gun control. And understand my last name is Rush, and it's on the Declaration. Dr. Benjamin Rush is a direct descendant. I'm a direct descendant of that gentleman who was best friends with Ben Franklin out of Pennsylvania. And those men didn't trust the government. And when I hear people talk like AR rifles are, you know, some kind of evil and that 100-round magazines are evil, I ask you, we're supposed to be able to have an armed militia, quote unquote, to fight the government. I'm a hunter, and I don't need an AR to hunt animals. But I would need
Rush, yeah. let me just ask you this. Conservatives have been pouring money into the Pentagon for the last 50 years. How are you going to do with your AR-15 against a tank? Or how are you going to do with your AR-15 against a bomber? So how tell me about how that battle goes.
All right, let me take you back to something I believe.
No, Rush, how is that battle going to go? How well are you going to do against an armored tank that conservatives have boosted for the last 50 years? I mean, our military is well-funded, it's well-armed, and if they ever come after you, if they use their tank against you, how are you going to do?
Are you going to let me answer your question?
Of course, that's why I'm here.
I'll take you back to something I believe in called the Bible.
No. How are you going to do? Don't bring up the Bible. How are you going to do when that tank comes after you and says that you're the enemy? You know, if you think that the government is going to someday target you as the enemy, how are you going to do with your AR-15 and a tank?
I'm trying to be respectful and have a conversation, but if you'd let me answer.
Well, I'm hoping you'll answer. Please answer.
Goliath was over 9 feet tall.
No. I'm not asking about Goliath. I'm asking about you and your AR-15. And, Alan, I'm sorry to say you didn't answer the question. I know it's a hard one. I know it's difficult, but you didn't answer it. We're out of time. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 a.m. Stay tuned for your hero, Mark Bureau. He's coming up next. Frank Knox has been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF in Tampa. Here's the latest news.